education research has a problem. The work of brilliant education researchers often doesn't reach the practice of brilliant teachers. Classroom Caffeine is here to help. Each week, I invite a top education researcher to sit down and talk with teachers about what they have learned from years of study. This week, Dr. Peter Smagorinsky talks to us about standardized testing, listening to diverse voices, the realities of the school day, and the impacts of politics on education. Peter is known for his work in teaching and learning English, writing methods, and inclusive instructional practices. Dr. Smagorinsky is a distinguished research professor at the University of Georgia and a distinguished visiting scholar at the Universidad de Guadalajara. You can learn more about Peter at the end of this episode. So, pour a cup of your favorite morning drink and join me, your host, Lindsay Persaud, for Classroom Caffeine, research to energize your teaching practice. Peter, thank you for joining me. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
From your own experiences in education, will you share with us one or two moments that inform your thinking now?
So before we started, Lindsay and I were talking about how hard this question has been answered. I'm 68 years old and I've been in the ed business since my early 20s. So it's kind of, I was wondering where in the world do I find one or two things that are worth talking about? And so I'm gonna answer that beginning when I was a high school student and I had to take SAT, PSAT, you know, I had to take a relatively small set of standardized tests, all of which I hated. And then after that, when I was done with college and was looking at grad schools, I had to take the GRE. And every time I took these exams, I would score about 150 points higher in math than my verbal test. And to project my life out after that, so keep in mind, my verbal score was okay. My math scores were always kind of elite. I'm actually a terrible math student, and I've made a living as a writer. So, you know, it just didn't add up to me. Why do I keep getting good math scores? Why do I struggle in math classes? When I went to Kenyon College as a freshman, I took a placement exam and was put in the advanced math group. I lasted about 2 weeks, transferred back into basic math and got a C in it. I mean, this is the story of my life as a student. And again, then I became an English major and ended up being, you know, writing, publishing many hundreds of things over the course of my career in academia and as a teacher. And so standardized tests to me always were misguided. I think I figured out later that my math scores were largely attributable to the fact that they focus on geometry, which isn't math. And I'm good with shapes. I'm a landscape architect in my private time, and I create collages of things based on how they're shaped. And I think that was a real benefit. I had some natural ability with shapes that made me look good in math, even though I always struggled with particularly the abstractions of numbers. And then I thought that my poor verbal scores were due to the fact that that I was being asked to get correct answers for of questions posed about readings that I wasn't interested in. And I'd often find myself drifting off during the test when I was reading these passages. And as a result, I appeared to be okay verbally when most people who know me consider me to be a highly verbal person. So going back to when I was young, in my mid-teens, I hated standardized tests. And then early in my career as a teacher, I had to stop and do maybe a week of SAT test prep. And I thought this was the biggest imposition of my time that I could possibly imagine. I did it very cynically. I did it very carelessly. I was supposed to do it. I was kind of rebelling against the fact that my teaching was being interrupted to prepare things for people that I considered invalid. And if I had only known how bad things would get, I'd have considered myself lucky that I only had to give up a week for test prep that didn't reflect on me at all. You know, the whole idea was I was going to take this time out so that my students would get better scores for themselves. Although, of course, the test scores reflected on the communities. And one thing I recall about one of the three jobs I had was someone successfully ran for the school board with a campaign of, we want to maintain the appearance of excellent education with high test scores. And, you know, and I always rolled my eyes at all this stuff and thought it was a waste of time. But as my teacher ed career developed, the teaching profession increasingly became subjected to this sort of assessment. And everybody knows the problems that it's created for teachers now. They have to spend so much of their time doing test prep. They get tested, they get evaluated on the basis of either their students' test scores or maybe someone else's. So my sister was a math teacher in New Jersey, and she was held accountable for the test scores of students whose tests she proctored, even though they weren't her students. And, you know, there are a million and one stories like that in the profession. It's just so ridiculous. In response to one of your later questions, I'll talk about the role of the Department of Education. But it just seems that every Secretary of Education we've had has taken tests more and more seriously. Even though it's not clear what Betsy DeVos thought of tests because her whole agenda was on something else. She was worthless in a very different way from the way Arnie Duncan was. Arnie Duncan was completely worthless, but in a really immediately destructive way to the everyday lives of teachers who had to continue to do all this, you know, test after test after test after test. And, you know, it's demoralizing, and it takes time away from teaching and learning. And I still think it's invalid. You know, I think it's as invalid now as it was when I was mismeasured when I was 15 years old, which was many years ago. So I guess if I were to look at one kind of thread in my story of going from being a student to being a teacher to being a teacher educator, it's my resistance to the role of testing and the validity of testing in determining how teachers go about their work and determining how kids get evaluated. So that's how I'd start to answer the question, and I'm happy to elaborate if you want to ask any follow-ups.
Well, I think your point here is probably one that's very validating to teachers, you know, to hear someone who has done so much work in the field of education to say that, you know, these tests are disruptive and not in a good way. They're truly invalid in multiple ways. Mm-hmm. And I think they force teachers to really try to bend over backwards to meet mandates that in the long run, I would say they're not productive, but it's worse than that. You know, they've really taken away from what can happen in schools.
Right. And then, you know, I was a literate, semi-affluent white kid. I'm part of the population that it's supposed to do a good job with, and it's still screwed up. But, you know, I think, well, what if I'd grown up in a housing project? The assumption is the playing field is level between those kids and the ones at the, you know, the ritziest schools. You know, if kids are hungry and are wearing the same clothes all week, how are they supposed to be thinking about multiple choice items on things that they don't care about? And how's that supposed to reflect anything about who they are, who their teachers are, what kind of school they go to? Fact is, there's a lot more important going on to those kids than taking these tests. So I think that the testing, of course, everybody I know thinks the same thing. These tests are disruptive, they're invalid, they're offensive. And I think that they're driving a lot of people out of the business, because that's not what people... Every teacher I know says, I got into teaching because I love kids, because I want to help kids, because I care about students. I love my subject matter. No one gets in and says, I want to go on proctor exams. Why would anyone want to do that? And so paid poorly, and then treated poorly. And I, first of all, I'm a public school advocate, but my fiance was in a public middle school last year that was so oppressively test-driven that she couldn't stand it and got out. And she got a job in a small little Catholic school for this year. And she applied to many schools. This is the one that offered her a job. She wasn't looking to get out of public and into private. She took the job that was offered. And it's just a different environment, much smaller, not so many tests, not a centralized curriculum, not prescriptive. And she gets paid nothing, but she's happy. And, you know, it's the kind of work that people wanting to get into teaching for, and the kind of work that they're often required to do in schools is not enjoyable. So I what I don't want to do is be too discouraging, but the landscape, because of policymakers, not because of kids. You know, sometimes people will say, well, the kids are so terrible. Well, I don't think the kids are all that terrible. They're no worse than I was. But the conditions are so different. The top-down nature of everything, the centralized nature of everything is discouraging.
Well, I see a real issue. Whenever we think about what we're really doing in schools is trying to teach kids how to think. And if we expect teachers not to think themselves and instead just to follow the script and follow the plan that's been handed to them, I think that task becomes even more difficult. You know, how do you teach someone to do something that you aren't able to exercise yourself?
Right. And how do teachers perform when they believe no one trusts them to make their own decisions based on their own judgment and knowledge of kids, teaching, learning, schools, and all these things? And I'll just give one of the examples from the school that she was in last year. They were very subservient to books written by Lucy Calkins. And there was one lesson that was scripted for 10 minutes. When she taught it, it ran 12 minutes and she got written up for it. And you know, that sort of and needless to say, she got out. Who's going to teach in a school like that? Who's got initiative and judgment and creativity and imagination and a personality, when what you're really looking for is a robot who can teach a 10-minute lesson in 10 minutes, whether the kids need 30 minutes or not.
And I think that you really hit one of the saddest things in my mind about education right now is that loss of being able to drive your curriculum and your school day based upon the needs of kids.
Of the needs of kids and your judgment, your training, your intelligence, your initiative. When I look back on my teaching, I had all that. I mean, I look back on that and think, holy smoke. As much as I complained about being managed, you know, it was a liberation city back then.
Well,
I did complain a lot at the time about being overly managed and having to do this week of test prep. I complained bitterly about all those things.
Right. And who would have thought that week would bleed into an entire school year?
Yeah.
So, Peter, I know you've done a lot of work to try to solve some of these challenges of education. So what would you like teachers to know about your research?
So, I've done actually a lot of different things, but I want to focus on something that I think is not attended to enough. So I did a lot of work studying teachers moving from teacher-led programs out into the workforce. And the original impetus for that work, and Pam Grossman and Sheila Valencia were my co-PIs at different sites, principal investigator PI. And our initial question was common in teacher education, which is, oh, we teach them to do all these cool things in teacher ed, and then 2 years later, they're out in the schools and they're teaching by the book, or, you know, they're doing what they call traditional instruction, you know, lecture, tests, and blah, blah, blah. You know, what happens? Why does that happen? And so we had a pretty robust set of case studies that we were able to do over a 5-year period at what ended up being 3 institutions in a total of 5 programs. And what I found from going over these cases again and again and again, and I it took me 20 years to go through all this. And the book that just came out this year, or something, I forget the title, Vygotskian Concept Development or something like that. I really became interested in, I think the question of this transition feeds into a bigger question, is how do people develop conceptions of how to teach effectively? I think the mistake made in teacher education is thinking that the thing that we're emphasizing in that methods class is the only thing that they'll ever be influenced by. But the fact is that teachers are being, at one point I said, they're not being drawn and quartered, they're being drawn in 16th. They're being pulled in dozens of different directions at the same time, all the time. So there's a sort of Deweyan progressivism that tends to be emphasized throughout teacher ed. But kids have gone to schools and been socialized into understanding teaching to be pretty authoritarian. So they have this deep image, this schema for what teachers do based on their apprenticeship of observation, their experiences as students, which now, one of the things we found in this work is, if you go back to Dan Lordy, who introduced the concept in the 70s, really based on research from the 60s, it was a very conserving, the apprenticeship of observation was pretty similar to everyone, and he found it to be a very conserving effect. Teachers do have far greater exposure now because they have the internet. That, like when I got my teaching credentials in the 70s, pretty much what I knew was what I learned in my classes. There were no Zoom meetings back then. There wasn't email back then.
No podcasts.
No podcasts back then. You either had to buy a book or go to a conference just to have contact with anyone outside your little bubble of influence. Then when you go from your program into a school, you go, oh, God, look at all these people went to different schools. They have different beliefs. Although by and large, everyone comes in with these Deweyan, you know, with a foundation of Deweyan progressivism in their formal approach, but at the same time, then that gets layered on top of what I've started calling the deep structure of schools. And the deep structure of schools is everything that holds, that provides continuity across time in a school, and it tends to be very conserving. So if you go back to the original conception of schools in the mid-1800s by Horace Mann, they were designed to be assimilative. The whole purpose of mass education was to take all these European immigrants from all these different cultural backgrounds, largely European though, and meld them into a nation, to have a national identity where everybody saluted the same flag, everyone spoke the same language, everybody learned the same facts, kind of a cultural literacy approach to there. And at the same time, the whole notion of a normal school, that's what teacher ed schools, that's what a teacher ed school was. It was called a normal school. If you think of Illinois State University, it's in Normal, Illinois. And it's a weird name until you realize that that's what it meant. The whole idea was to perpetuate norms. And then the question is, well, whose norms? So we're trying to assimilate. Purpose of schools and becoming a teacher was to assimilate to what we all would probably call now white middle class norm. And that structure has never budged from the conduct of school. And it's realized in the kinds of things you're allowed to say, the kinds of turn-taking that are allowed in class, the kinds of clothes you're allowed to wear, the way you're allowed to wear your hair. So you've probably seen stories of, there was a story of a black wrestler, and the referee said, cut your hair or you forfeit. So much for celebrating diversity. And so you have things like celebrate diversity is in every mission statement of every school. We respect the culture, blah, blah, blah. And then they get there, but they can't wear their hair like that. They can't dress in a certain way. There are schools where people who wear headscarves are told they got to take them off. If you've ever seen the difference between a black church and a white church, one's much more participatory and louder and passionate and involved. And the kids are socialized to understand that that's acceptable behavior in a formal setting. They do that in classroom, and they're sent to the discipline office because the deep structure of the school is very unbudging. And so there are so many things that are at odds with each other in teaching. You're constantly amidst contradiction. And it's not just polar opposites. You might be told, okay, standardized testing here, but we're also going to have cultural diversity, and we're going to have character education, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that. And the pieces don't fit together. And then they gravitate to the assimilative function of schools, because that's the center of gravity for everything. One of the things I've heard very often is, oh, teachers are so inconsistent. And I say, no, teachers are in inconsistent environments that pull them in different directions. And so they might emphasize the official meaning of a story while also having open-ended interpretation. The two don't mix theoretically. But what you have is competing traditions that teachers kind of shift among in their instruction. And sometimes those contradictions can be experienced in unsettling ways by kids who are trying to figure out what they're supposed to do well in that class. And in my background as an English teacher, I really don't know how a math class would work. So I was writing an article on this sort of thing, and a lot of educational research is depicted in graphs and charts. I've never been very good at graphs and charts. Diagrams, I don't even get. And so we were trying to figure out, how do we show this set of contradictions that teachers have to work within? And I ended up enlisting the service of a former student of mine named Michelle Zoss, who's done a number of cover art things. And we asked her to draw a picture of a teacher kind of walking down a pathway that it more or less has different things shouting at her from different places, telling her to do different things. And instead of walking forward, her head is turned as though she's being distracted. And to me, that captured what teachers go through. And so my original goal was to study concept development as a path, but the problem is that path isn't even there, because there are multiple paths that cross each other and circle back and go straight up, and some go straight down, and it's a very perplexing profession, because the clarity of purpose is not there. And meanwhile, you have the deep structure of a school privileging certain values and priorities. So I would say, if I have any wisdom to share, is don't expect consistency of yourself, because the reward system doesn't work that way. The approval system doesn't work that way. You're just being torn in many directions at the same time all the time.
Peter, you've really got me thinking about where I would call them the internal conflicts of teachers really come from. You've got me thinking about how teachers are sort of set down in the middle of this system that wasn't designed to meet the needs of all students. It was designed to meet the needs of those who want to normalize folks and kind of get them all together in one place. And when you say, that every school has diversity and inclusion in their mission statement, yes, I think you're absolutely right. And like you said, the deep structures of our schools aren't set up to help us meet those missions. So of course we're going to feel torn and pulled in many different directions. How do we navigate that?
Well, one of the problems of being really democratic is that everybody gets a voice. And if you legitimize everyone's voice, it's hard to have agreement. So we're kind of victims of our own efforts at equity, even though those efforts at equity tend to silence certain voices. You don't have to be a genius to know which ones they are. There are people on the margins. And I've always believed that the real value of diversity is not in its celebration, but it's in the admission of perspectives that the people at the center of authority don't have the life experience to even think about. And that's why I think it's very important not just to have different colored people, but to have different life experiences present in any discussion of how to operate a community operation like a school. I remember when I was a high school teacher, my black students would tell me how often they got pulled over by police. And these were not crazy kids running around, you know, firebombing the city hall. These were the student government kids, the student athletes, kind of, you know, the good kids. And they said, oh yeah, we get pulled over all the time. And I don't get pulled over all the time. I would never have known that if I hadn't been exposed to the kids and listened to them. And that was really my first experience understanding what now people are starting to see in the Black Lives Matter movement and the problems that have caused it. Yeah, black people sure do get pulled over a lot and beaten up a lot and all these things. But if when I look at the Georgia Board of Regents, it's all old white men appointed by Republican governors. They're never going to think of these things. It's completely outside their life experience. And I think that the regents are all the poorer for being all the same. So it's very important for these multiple perspectives to be available. It's also important to understand that celebrating diversity is a dumb idea because it's really hard. It's hard to accommodate all these voices in one effort. There are often intense disagreements. The people who have lacked access to these decision-making opportunities are often angry. They often feel marginalized. They're often treated as marginal people. And celebrating diversity sounds good, and it looks great on a poster with a lot of different colored kittens snuggling together. If it were that easy, we'd all be doing it. But diversity is hard, and you've got to work at it. You've got to be committed to listening. And I don't think that it's not just a Southern problem. It was a problem in the Chicago area schools I worked in too.
Right. And I know you're in Georgia and I'm in Florida, and certainly we do see some of the same kinds of issues in the places where we live. But I think you're right. I think this idea of celebrating diversity, it's just not enough. There has to be more than a celebration. We need everyone to actually have a seat at the table so that they can share their diverse experiences and help us understand what life is like through the eyes of someone else.
That's right. That's right. And do something about it then.
Right, right.
You have to be willing to listen. And a lot of people aren't. What they want to do is tell everybody how right they are. And that tends to be a trait, particularly the people who don't want to give anything up, you know, who have the authority and don't want to share it.
Right.
So the level of commitment is very deep, required in order for diverse communities to function effectively and achieve some kind of common cause in education or anything else. And show me where that's easy to do.
And yet celebrating just isn't enough.
Well, to me, it's a distraction, and it puts a smiley face on a hard problem.
Well, I think you've certainly shared with us a bit more about why you don't like standardized testing at all. It certainly is not designed. It's not designed to meet the needs of everyone.
That's right. That's why they're called standardized.
Right. Right.
And who writes them? Don't take a walk through ETS sometime. It's pretty white. I've been there. I've done work at ETS, and I don't remember meeting any black people there, or anybody else for that matter. They may have had some Asian number crunchers, but you know, they're not involved in items. You know,
right.
Like nutrition and a test item developer are a different character. And so unless you share decision making and make a real effort to broaden it, not just get a black person who fits in very well already with the white establishment, but people who can come in and say, wait a minute, y'all are wrong about this.
So how do we translate that to something at a classroom level? How can teachers take these ideas and empower their students and really also empower themselves to support diverse groups of students?
Well, I always look first to context, because the context may not allow it. There may be a standardization movement. I shouldn't oversell the experiences of my fiance too much. She came home with a story, and this is from the new school she's in, the one she loves. She had had her students read an essay about how the film The Black Panther, it was a twist on a genre, on the superhero genre. That was it. Because she had the students read that essay, a parent complained that she was promoting the Black Lives Matter agenda and was a historical revisionist and complained to the principal and all this stuff. So there are a lot of forces that weigh in on teachers and what they can do. And I think a real problem with what we do in teacher ed is pretend that there aren't things like that. Because these constraints, the context, tells you what you can do. If you have an authoritarian principal who is down here in the South, there's no teacher unions. If you get fired for being disobedient, I could tell you all the cool ideas in the world and I wouldn't be any good. So the first thing I think everybody needs to do is learn the context. You know, what is available in this place? And sometimes you do find that there are, if not loopholes, at least side doors. So a teacher I knew back in Norman, Oklahoma, wanted to teach The Color Purple, which is controversial because they're both lesbian and, you know, oh my God. And she just went through a process to get the book adopted. It took her a lot of time, but she was able to do it. This was in Norman, Oklahoma, which by standards of Oklahoma is a progressive city, but by the standards of it may be a little less so. But she found it, I don't want to say, in emphasizing context, I don't want to suggest that they're impenetrable and immovable, but they're there. But part of their there-ness could be these loopholes or side doors through which you might be able to get something done. But the idea of just closing your door the way I could do, that door is almost always open now. Somebody's watching everything you do by some means of surveillance. Just as teachers have to be surveillant of kids all the time, to the point where some of them are supposed to be collecting data with a clicker while they're leading discussions. I mean, how can you be involved in the discussion if you're, oh, Susie's inattentive, like, you know, somebody's looking out the window, somebody's reading a novel between. You can't lead the discussion and do that well, I don't think. But they're required to, because what matters most is the data get collected. And I'd be a pretty poor fit in a school like that.
That idea of working within the bounds of our own context, of course, understanding what those boundaries are, but it sounds like maybe what you're suggesting is that we not so quietly push against those boundaries a little bit.
Well, to the extent that you can, because you can't teach anybody if you're fired. And once you get fired, it's true. Hard to get rehired. So when she announced that she wasn't returning to that job, she was effectively banned from the county. No transfer for you.
And I know our listeners can't see me, but my eyes just got really big.
Yeah, so you can't, if you want to be a teacher, you have to understand that being a teacher involves certain compromises. And if you can't make them, might not be the best work for you.
But it's a dance we do, wouldn't you say, where you play by the rules in order to remain where you are. Yet I think we do have to push against the boundaries when we don't agree or when we don't think it's good for kids.
Well, I guess it depends on the kind of, first of all, the kind of leadership in your school and the kind of faculty organizations available. So there's a person that I've been in sessions with in the last few years, and the person's from New York, and his solution to everything is to go talk to your union rep. Well, that's great if you've got unions, but you know, Georgia is what they call right to work, which is really right to hire. And they have no job protection. I know people who've gone to work and been told their jobs are gone. because they weren't fitting in, which means they weren't obedient enough. So I don't like to encourage people to be so independent that they get fired and can't get another teaching job, because these things can follow you around. And I want to sit here and say, yeah, push back, be a rebel, tear down the walls and, be a 60s radical, but it's a good way to get fired where I live. And that's why I think you need to know your context to know, is this a place where I can do that? Is this a place where pushback is even possible? I mean, I'm in a university, and every time I push back, people get really mad at me, deans in particular.
Well, higher ed has certainly been subjected to a lot of the standardization that has happened in our K-12 schools as well. So I don't know that anyone can really escape this, which is why I think we do have to, maybe as you suggest, gently push back wherever we can in order to say, this isn't right and this isn't what is good for my students.
Yeah, but the last thing I'm going to do as a university professor is say that I'm in the same boat as a teacher, because we've got it easy.
Absolutely.
In terms of autonomy.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And I bitch and moan about, it used to be NCATE, now it's NTPA, all these things I complain bitterly about, because I don't think these things make me, what they make me do is waste time that I could better be putting into
teaching.
Research, service, anything, and your time gets eaten up by writing reports justifying your existence, sometimes internally with the institution, sometimes with these external audits, none of which have ever made me a better educator, none of which have ever improved the quality of life for my students. All they've done is provided reports. I don't think anyone ever reads.
Paperwork and checklists.
Yep. But again, it's a piece of cake relative to the daily micromanagement that teachers have to endure.
And I think that for me, my public school experience is not terribly far behind me. And I think that you really hit the nail on the head there with the word daily. Because, while in a university setting, we're inconvenienced by these things periodically, I would say.
Yeah.
But certainly in a public classroom, it is a daily imposition of someone else's ideas and agenda and endeavors that teachers are then left to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked a lot about the challenges of education. So given those challenges of today's educational climate, what message do you want teachers to hear?
Well, I was thinking about this, and I'm going to try to give a practical answer. President Carter created Secretary of Education as a cabinet position. I think it was largely symbolic at first. I don't recall them really doing anything. Increasingly, they've gotten more invasive, and Biden has promised a person with teaching experience in that role. I believe that person, it wouldn't be the first. For instance, Rod Page was a gym teacher who became a school administrator. He did his doctoral dissertation on the reaction time of offensive linemen in football. That qualified him to be the United States Secretary of Education. And, he as the superintendent in Houston, he'd become, there was some Houston miracle, which of course, like all these miracles, turned out to be a fraud. It's all based on gaming the system. But I think if I go back to when Obama became president and he had Linda Darling Hammond as the head of his transition team, I thought, well, this can only result in a good appointment, because, Obama's a humanistic person, cares about quality of life, he's thoughtful and empathic and all these things. And he picked Arne Duncan. It's hard to say whether he or DeVos is the worst Secretary of Education we've had. He was the worst in terms of this daily pressure to produce on tests. Kindergartners taking college and career readiness tests. I mean, give me a break.
Come on.
I,
yeah.
I didn't decide to teach until I was out of college. I don't know what my kindergarten assessment would have shown. Maybe that would have been, unless there was a career in going down to the creek and chasing frogs. I mean, that's about all that was my whole life. But, and then DeVos, her whole thing was trying to ruin public education by investing all the money in private schools. Two terrible secretaries in very different ways. So I think that these people do turn out to be consequential. And, you know, when I look at Betsy DeVos and think, what at a time when what we really need was for that education budget to be put into buses going and bringing internet to communities so the kids don't have to drive to McDonald's and try to do homework off a telephone by leeching off of their Wi-Fi. There was a huge infrastructure gap that the Secretary of Education should have recognized during the COVID shutdown and done something about. To me, that's much more important than standardized testing or giving all the money to private schools, undermining public education. There was a real pragmatic need for things to be practical, concrete things to be done to get us through 2020. And they weren't. None of them were done.
Right. Because without access, what do you have?
How can you Zoom if you can't get online?
Right.
And if you know teachers, you know that seems that half their day was just spent trying to get kids successfully to log in. And so what's the secretary doing going and talking to other billionaires about, you know, the need to cut their budgets even more? So I think that what I pay attention to these things. I pay attention to who's appointing whom for what, to what ends, because it does end up mattering. Those aren't just empty seats anymore. Those are now positions of authority with money behind them that could be invested well. I mean, anybody who thinks that we don't need a better infrastructure right now for schools to operate is crazy. We did a study, Lindy Johnson was one of my graduate students, and I was actually her research assistant on a project in a rural school about an hour from here. And it was a digital writing intervention, Writing 2.0 or something like that. Did a summer program. The teachers were really stoked. All these possibilities for using digital tools for writing instruction. They went back in the fall, and the state had gone to online testing that occupied bandwidth almost all the time, to the point where nothing we did was possible. So why is the secretary of, and that was before COVID, that's the sort of thing that just needs to be done, and that you could commit education dollars to make education more responsive to the times. So I guess, you know, this is something I used to just ignore all that national policy stuff. There's just a bunch of people far removed from schools arguing about things. But it turns out they do matter. And I think teachers should pay attention to it and lobby for and support people who understand teaching. And I sure hope Biden is right or follows through on his promise to put an educator in charge of education. Arne Duncan, I think, was a superintendent of Chicago schools, but had never been a teacher. And he was not a very good superintendent. And then he became a lousy, really destructive secretary of education, even though he's still going around claiming that he was incredible. And he's still wrong. So I guess that's my parting message. I think if there's a form of activism, it's to make sure that the right people are making the right decisions to make schools work better in ways that teachers and kids believe in.
So maybe our days of just disassociating with bad policy and bad practice are over. And just like celebrating diversity maybe ought to be a first step, I think disassociating is also a first step here in really becoming more active in the policies and decisions that end up impacting all of us.
Yeah, and I know, and I don't want to suggest that teachers have all this spare time, because I know they don't. When they're not preparing for tests, they're calling parents and doing lunchroom duty and
million other tasks every day. Right.
And there's no way I would suggest that they should just start doing this. But I do think that there are avenues of participation that I hope become important enough to them to take action with, because I think that they're the most important voices in all that, even though they're the most muted voices in the public. And they're not controlling the mute button. Somebody else is.
Yep, I would agree with that. Well, Peter, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for your contributions to the field of education, and thank you for your message to teachers.
Well, thanks so much. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I wish anybody going into the business a happy career, and I hope that the profession emerges from these times to be one that people want to do.
Teaching really is one of the most fulfilling and certainly the most important job in our democratic society. We just have to find a way to reclaim our individual thought and to, like I said before, meet the needs of individual students.
Right on.
Yep. Well, thank you again, Peter.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Peter Smagorinsky is known for his work in the field of English, literacy education, teacher education, and inclusive teaching practices. His research and teaching take a sociocultural approach to issues of literacy education, literacy teacher preparation, and related social concerns. He has published more than 100 articles and 70 book chapters, and authored or edited 30 books, including two in 2020, Learning to Teach English and Language Arts, A Vygotskian Perspective on Beginning Teachers' Pedagogical Concept Development, and Developing Culturally and Historically Sensitive Teacher Education, Global Lessons from a Literacy Education Program, co-edited with Yolanda Gale and Patricia Rosas. His interest in neurodiversity has also produced two recent edited collections, Creativity and Community Among Autism Spectrum Youth, Creating Positive Social Uplifts Through Play and Performance from Palgrave Macmillan, and Dismantling the Disabling Environments of Education, Creating New Cultures and Contexts for Accommodating Difference, co-edited with Joe Tobin and Kanghua Lee. From 2012 to 2020, Peter served as the faculty advisor to the student-led Journal of Language and Literacy Education at University of Georgia. From 1996 to 2003, he co-edited with Michael W. Smith Research in the Teaching of English. He was recently awarded the 2020 Horace Mann League Outstanding Public Educator Award and has notably won the 2018 International Federation for the Teaching of English Award and the 2018 Distinguished Scholar Recognition from the National Conference on Research in Language and Literacy. Dr. Smagorinsky is a distinguished research professor in the Department of Language and Literacy Education at the University of Georgia, and a distinguished visiting scholar at the Universidad de Guadalajara in Jalisco, Mexico. For the good of all students, good research should inform good practice, and vice versa. Listeners are invited to respond to our guests, learn more about our guest research, and suggest a topic for an upcoming episode through this podcast website at classroomcaffeine.com. If you've learned something today or just enjoyed listening, please subscribe to this podcast. I raise my mug to you, teachers. Thanks for joining me.